Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. The war for the free world has become a lot more of a war, an active war of late, and one of the people who is both monitoring it closely and in a position to help it come out right is our first guest. She is Congresswoman Ileana Rose-Laitinen. She is a path-breaking member of the United States House of Representatives, having served now for some 32 years in various public service capacities, starting in her native Florida. She is currently the Chairman Emeritus of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and chairs its Middle East subcommittee. She's a dear friend of this program, and it's always a pleasure to welcome her back.
Hey, thanks so much, Frank. It's a pleasure to be on here. There are just so many topics, not just related to our subcommittee, Middle East and North Africa, but Cuba, where I was born. Just a lot of good things that we can talk about.
Well, a lot to talk about, too little time, so let's jump into it. As you say, you have a subcommittee that has jurisdiction over an important part of this battle space and what I call the war for the free world. Talk a little bit about your thoughts on the emergence of this group ISIS out of Syria, now very much a presence in Iraq. You've called, as I understand it, for airstrikes against those forces. Why and how would that work as you see it at the present time?
Well, of course, the tricky thing there is the president going to come to Congress to ask for authorization? Will he act on his own? And we have seen a president who's so hesitant whenever this lead from behind. He's taking it quite literally. We saw that indecisiveness leading to a terrible consequences in Syria, where he said, yes, he's going to take action. And then he said, I'm going to come to Congress. Meanwhile, he's been ignoring Congress all of these years. And yet, when he was faced with what he thought would be unpopular and something that he did not want to do, then he says, let me see if Congress will okay it. And of course, that went nowhere fast because the Republicans are hesitant to give such authority when we don't know how long we would be involved. And I believe that I favored airstrikes against Syria and still do, but we've moved way beyond that. But it's the indecisiveness of the president that's showing its ugly face again, unfortunately, in Iraq, where we have this new development. It's been developing for many years, but it's going to be the leading terrorism entity, ISIS, and I worry that this lead from behind strategy of the president is going to lead to disastrous consequences. Now, Secretary Kerry was over there. Something that he said worries me because I worry about Iran's role in all of this. And this is what Kerry said. Iran's neighbors can bolster Iraq's security as well as their own. I'm not sure if he's making reference to Iran. He says the president has said he will do what is necessary. I don't know when that will be. And has moved into the assets into place, has been gaining each day the assurances he needs. But I worry about Iran's role here. And Frank, yesterday our committee met with the ambassadors from Saudi Arabia and from the UAE, and they're also very worried about what's going to happen. ISIS and the Taliban, they're very enraged about the swap for Baghdad for the five Taliban. That is because Qatar to them is a real problem, and that's the hotbed of Muslim Brotherhood and all kinds of terrorist acts. So that whole area is going south really fast.
You've put a lot of food on the table there, Ileana. Let me just quickly ask you, in terms of Iran, one of the concerns I've had, I think, is that were the United States, in fact, to engage in airstrikes, and let's start by saying much of this probably would have been unnecessary had the president not withdrawn all Americans from Iraq, but we are where we are on that. Might we not find ourselves in a situation where we're kind of making common cause with the Iranians? And I fully share your concern about those guys were we to go after ISIS under these circumstances.
Well, I very much worry that after we've been saying all of these years that Iran is the leading sponsor of terrorism, and my subcommittee has had hearing after hearing about how what a terrible human rights record it has in how they sponsor terrorism, and they're the ones who started the fire, and now we're going to call on Iran to be the firefighter. It makes no sense. So I very much worry about where Obama stands, what he's going to do. And it leads us to Afghanistan. What is going to be happening there? We left Iraq in such a hurry that we didn't create the problem. Of course, the terrorists are always the ones who are responsible. But we shouldn't be leaving a situation really as an open door for all of these terrorist groups and all of these jihadists, all of these militants to come in. And after all that blood and treasure has been shed there, to see a little gain for it. And we have a failed leader, no doubt, but we've known that all along. Al-Maliki is, just like Karzai, has been a great disappointment. Al-Maliki is cozying up to Iran. Are we now going to not only negotiate this bad, weak nuclear deal, but also we're going to have Iran be a helper in trying to find a way to deal with ISIL or ISIL? You know, you go either way with how you call it. So it's a problem, Frank.
And before we leave Iran, very quickly, and again, our guest is Eliana Rose Leighton, and she is the chairman emeritus of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and now chairs its Middle East Subcommittee, representing the people of the 27th District of Florida. On the negotiations with Iran, are you seeing anything there other than continued progress by the Iranians towards nuclear weapons capability?
I believe that is exactly right, the way you said it. Advancement, progress toward nuclear capability. This is a bad deal, a very weak deal. And if we don't get to that deadline, which is coming up in a month, what is going to happen? Are we going to, then Iran is going to say, well, now we have the right to enrich, which a right that they have always asserted that they have. We're the only ones who say that they won't be enriching. Iranians have been saying all along, we do have that right, and we will continue to do so. In fact, in our conditions, we never set forth one that said, you will stop enriching and you will not develop anything like that in the future. The conditions that we place on Iran have been very weak, and now we further embolden Iran with what is going on in Iraq. And I worry very much about what will happen if and when we don't have a deal, and I hope that we don't, because it's a very bad deal for the United States. But that will mean that Iran will say, okay, no deal, then we're going to go full throttle, and which is ludicrous to say, because they've never stopped. The centrifuges have never stopped spinning.
This must really break your heart, Eliana Rose Leighton, and as you were very instrumental, of course, in getting the sanctions in place that created in some people's minds the opportunity for negotiations. They've now been substantially diminished, particularly internationally.
You know, Frank, they really are nothing. I was the author, along with my colleagues, of the strongest Iran sanctions bill, the ones that are on the books. But
over the objection of the Obama administration, let us say.
Oh, my gosh. They have used every waiver that we had to put in there in order to pass the bill. They have said all along, this is for national security's sake. We cannot do this part, and we cannot fulfill this part. So it's been an interesting historical document for academics and historians to ponder in the years to come, but it has not really been enforced.
If only were just academic. This is of such strategic importance. Quickly, last topic of the day. You have been also very skeptical of the advisability of allowing a so-called unity government in the Palestinian areas to continue to benefit from American largesse as well as political support. Where does that stand at the moment, and how bad an idea do you think what the administration is doing is?
Well, the administration is so weak. As you know, they've always been putting a lot of pressure on Israel. They've not let up on that pressure, hardly any pressure on the Palestinians to do the right thing. And now we've got this unity government. Now the administration is trying to pull the wool over our eyes, knowing that there's a law that says any member of Hamas, if you're a member of Hamas, you cannot receive any money from the United States if you belong to any group. That means no money for the Palestinians, which is the right thing to do. But the administration administration is now bending over saying, well, these are not really members of Hamas. They're technocrats. They're just bureaucrats to keep the government running. There is no such difference in the law. The law is clear. No money for the Palestinians, if any member of Hamas is in its unit. And so we're going to hold the administration's feet to the fire. That's money that we could use elsewhere for people who really want peace with Israel and people who respect Israel's right to exist as a democratic Jewish state.
Amen. Ileana Rose-Leighton, thank you so much for your leadership on all of these things. We'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, Claudia Rosette gives us another take on Iran's ambitions and what they might mean for all of us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Claudia Rosette. She is the journalist in residence at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and also a PJ Media and Forbes.com columnist. You are almost certainly familiar with her writings. They are voluminous, both as a result of her current activities and her past incarnations, notably as an editorial writer in the Wall Street Journal and a foreign correspondence par excellence, also her extraordinarily important investigative reporting, which, among other things, disclosed Saddam Hussein's oil for food scandal. Claudia Rosette, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
Well, Iraq is much in the news again, and in part it is casting a fresh light on what Iran is up to, Claudia. And as someone who has been following their activities for a long time, notably but not exclusively at the United Nations, I thought it might be a good idea to sort of take stock with you as to what the Iranian game is at the moment. Among other things, can we consider them, as President Obama seems to think, as a reliable partner, either for negotiations on their nuclear weapons program, or worse, perhaps as a partner in countering the Sunni insurgency in Iraq?
No, they're the world's leading terrorist sponsoring state, and you know they kill Americans. They've been doing it. They were doing it in Iraq when we had a troop presence there. They've been doing it in Afghanistan. They have done it around the globe since the 1979 founding of the Islamic Republic, and this is not a country to rely on in any way. They're working on nuclear weapons, and there's the fact that there have been nuclear talks going on in Vienna, and before that in Geneva, as they arranged for these talks for months and months, does not in any way mean that Iran has become actually less dangerous, less malign in its ambitions. This is an extremely dangerous, predatory regime, Frank, and it's been that way since 1979. It is still that way. And this is not a partner.
We're visiting with Claudia Rosette, a longtime columnist and correspondent and investigative reporter now with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And Claudia, you had a piece in the Wall Street Journal on the 20th of June talking about using perhaps North Korea as a cutout for the Iranian nuclear weapons program. This is something that seems to have been going on to varying degrees for some time. Do you think that the likelihood is increasing as a result of these negotiations that that will be the vehicle that the Iranians use to obtain a full nuclear weapons capability?
Frank, it's an obvious potential workaround for one. Quite a number of reasons, but the glaring one is there's only one country known to have tested nuclear weapons since, or known to have conducted nuclear tests, so those are tests for nuclear weapons, since 1998 when India and Pakistan last conducted tests, and that country is North Korea. So if you want to farm out to somebody your proxy, by proxy, a nuclear test, that is the go-to, that would seem to me the go-to country. Now, there are a lot of other reasons, including decades of close ties between North Korea and Iran. There has actually not been any official confirmation from the U.S. government that the two countries cooperate on nuclear programs. The administration is extremely coy about this. I think at this point we should be told much more if they know more. There is, however, extensive testimony, statements, reports, documentation, and so on, of years and years, decades of close cooperation between North Korea and Iran on missile programs, missile development, ever more sophisticated missile development, in other words, delivery systems for nuclear warheads, among other things. And because they have cooperated so closely, again, that's another reason why North Korea would be an obvious go-to place if Iran wants to say to the world, look, we're giving up this project, and meanwhile farming out somewhere else.
And, you know, as we've discussed in the past, Claudia Rosette, the fact that we have Wendy Sherman, who was the architect of the failed deal with the North Koreans during the Clinton administration, now having her hand in the the negotiations with the Iranians, seems to me to make all the more likely that this hash-up will be completed in a fashion similar to the one you've described. Let me turn to a slightly different topic, Claudia. We've had further indications that the Iranians are bending the United Nations to their will. They've received yet another senior posting from which to exercise their influence, and unfortunately, it seems to me to work their will with a lot of other countries using the sort of rubric of international norms and arrangements to protect themselves from our criticism and the like. To the extent that they're doing that, and to the extent that they are perfectly prepared to deal with Sunni extremists when it serves their purposes, including apparently al-Qaeda and ISIS, this really seems to me to be kind of the sort of outfit that we shouldn't be having anything to do with, let alone negotiating or considering enabling on the battlefield.
Well, that's basically right. You know, I wish I could argue with you, Frank. But that's the problem. You know, there has been a history at this point of the U.S. Under this administration much too often dismissing real allies. You know, Israel is the country that certainly comes to mind there, treating them dismissively, giving them ultimatums, bullying them, pressuring them, while looking to countries that are into countries, organizations, that are enemies of the United States, and hoping that good treatment, friendly treatment, trust, and so on will somehow bring them around. And that's not the way the world works. And this is being noticed by a great many actors in the world today. And, you know, there are conclusions being drawn, I think, as far away as China. They're watching what is happening in the Middle East. Actually, China isn't that far. It's highly entwined with the Middle East. But they're watching the precedents that are being set there. Countries in Latin America are looking at, you know, what is the U.S. doing with its allies, with its enemies, and it's very much inverted right now. You know, it almost looks as if the safest position to be in the world these days is a bitter enemy desiring the demise of the American system, in which case the U.S. may treat you well. To be an ally of the U.S. is to be in a very dangerous spot.
Better to be an enemy than a friend. You're likely to have a lot more enemies than friends. Claudia, very quickly, let me turn to one other topic. You've spent a lot of time in Russia, the Soviet Union, for that matter. You understand its workings probably as well as anybody in the West. There is a report today that Vladimir Putin has asked the Duma, the parliament there, to rescind a resolution that or authorization of the use of military force in Ukraine, if it were needed. This is taken widely as evidence that the crisis is abating and his ambitions to act in a sort of hegemonic way there are receding. Is that your view, or should we take rather a dimmer view of what Vladimir Putin is up to?
No, I take that as a Potemkin move at most. You know, he's asked the Duma. He doesn't need to ask the Duma. He can do whatever he wants to. He's effectively the dictator of Russia. Yeah, this is window dressing. This can be advertised in Washington and places like that as Europe, the capitals of Europe. Look, Russia is backing down, backing away. No, Putin, this is a long game.
Yeah, no need for sanctions here, folks. Everything's coming up roses. Claudia, I'm afraid you're right, as usual, on this and so many other topics. We look forward to further visits with you, both on the Iraq story, the Iran temper, the nuclear weapons programs, what Putin is up to, and more. Your work is indispensable at Forbes.com and PJ Media. Keep it up. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll talk about some of these issues with another member of Congress, Congressman Duncan Hunter. Straight ahead.
Visit us at Facebook.com/Secure Freedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hey. Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Recent developments in the Mideast have exposed the fraud that was President Obama's claim to have ended the war in Iraq. Unfortunately, most of us are still unclear about the nature of the enemies still very much in the fight. The confusion has grown as the Obama administration considers aiding Islamists of the Shiite stripe in Iraq against Islamists of the Sunni persuasion, including, evidently, some it has been funding, arming, and training in Syria. What these jihadists have in common is that they all adhere to a shared Islamic supremacist and totalitarian doctrine. They call it Sharia and believe that their God, Allah, has decreed Sharia will govern worldwide. Once we're clear about what impels our enemies, we have a chance of defeating them. If we aren't, we won't. Period. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined, I'm very pleased to say, by another very distinguished member of the United States House of Representatives. He's Congressman Duncan Hunter. He represents California's 50th district. He's a member of the House Armed Services Committee, serving on its Sea Power and Power Projection Forces Subcommittee, as well as its Intelligence, Emerging Threats, and Capabilities Subcommittee, among other responsibilities. Duncan Hunter, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Duncan, you have, of course, the distinction of being a veteran of both Iraq and Afghanistan in the United States House, as well as serving in a senior position on this Armed Services Committee. Talk a little bit about your perspective on what is developed now as a result of the abandonment of Iraq, it seems to me, and what's likely to come next.
It was interesting. I was a lieutenant on the ground in Iraq twice, and then in Afghanistan, I made captain. But meaning I didn't have any geopolitical strategic point of view at that point in time in 2003. And then in Fallujah in 2004, I was just out there trying to kill bad guys and protect my guys. But just being in Congress, I've had a chance to look at it and kind of playing out with what I saw on the ground simply in the combat role. And here's what I see there. You have the Peshmerga in Kurdistan, who are our allies. The ISIS hasn't crossed the border there yet, and I don't think that they will. I think that the Kurds will keep them out. If we have anybody to work with who are not friendly to the Iranians or the bad guys in Iraq or the Syrians, it's the Kurds there. So I think that presents an opportunity for us, for people that we can get with. We can find some safety there, and we can kind of push out and push ISIS if we wanted to. Number two, Syria. You got to solve the Syria problem. It's like trying to fix Afghanistan without fixing Pakistan. It's impossible because you got guys who can cross over freely from Syria to Iraq and then to Iran. It just makes a big swath of terrorism badlands. And number three, my dad, who was chairman of the Armed Services Committee during the war in Iraq, basically came up with this idea, and I think it's a pretty good one. You had a lot of Marines and Army generals and colonels who became very close with the Sunnis in the Sunni Triangle, the different Sunni tribes, where you had the Sunni awakening there around Fallujah and Ramadi and these really bad places, where they basically kicked out al-Qaeda because they were tired of being abused by them. So we got to get these old hands back, guys like General Mattis, General Kelly. In the Marine Corps, there's different Army generals. Some of them have retired. Some are still active duty. Get them back over there because they've established relationships over 2 to 5 years with these Sunni tribesmen and the sheikhs there. So anyway, that's an idea too. We don't have to reestablish relationships. We have guys that have served over there and spent a lot of time and established a trust with them. We got to get them back over there. In the end, though, I think we're past the point of no return, and all we can do now is contain and try to mitigate damage.
I take it you're concerned about the idea of collaborating with the Iranians in whatever we try to do on the ground in Iraq at this point.
I am to a certain degree, but my role, I guess you can take it as an unsophisticated, blunt role, or my idea about America's role there. We should be killing as many bad guys as possible because we gave up the ability to work with the government and try to do soft power there when we left. So right now, what we should be working on is military victories. Just because we're killing the same group of guys that the Iranians are trying to kill doesn't make us co-conspirators with the Iranians. Because at some point, I mean, I don't want to speak flippantly, but at some point things could switch and we may be looking at each other across the end of a gun barrel. That doesn't mean that we don't strike ISIS just because the Iranians are striking ISIS too.
To the extent that we've got the capacity to do that at this point, your concern, I know, has been the diminishing of our military capabilities by this administration. The president's talked about a more focused, more targeted strategy, but in the absence of power projection capability, talk about this from the perspective, if you would, Congressman Duncan Hunter, of a man both with combat experience yourself and now serving on the Sea Power Subcommittee of the Armed Services Committee. Do we have what we need in light of the kinds of dangers that are clearly growing by the day?
No, we don't have what we need to be everywhere, right? We obviously, we have a hard time being in the Pacific and Eastern Asia and also being down in Southwest Asia and then being in the Middle East at the same time and keeping an eye on Russia. So there's a whole lot of places we have to be. We don't have the ability to be everywhere at once. And you have more risk now than you ever have. But on the flip side of that coin, DOD is still getting $600 billion a year. Pre-9/11, they were getting around $300 billion a year. So their ability to spend money has doubled. They have double the amount of money they had pre-9/11, but our capability hasn't doubled. And that's a problem we're working on. We have an acquisitions hearing today in the Armed Services Committee because what you see with the Department of Defense is a lot of squandering of our capability. They have more money than they've ever had, yet they have less capability than they should have by anyone's account.
This is really the crux of the problem, it seems to me, for the longer term, and I'm glad you're on that case. Let me turn to one other topic, if I may, Congressman, knowing that you are hailing from a border community down in San Diego in Southern California. We're looking at an increasing problem, I don't need to tell you, with people coming across a border that remains all too porous. What is your general view of the extent to which we've invited this invasion? I think it's the only accurate way to describe it. And what should we be doing about it?
Sure. Specifically, I think that the administration has invited this. They've asked for it by talking about amnesty. And these are all kids. I understand they're the majority are males over 14, 15 years old. You can't tell whether they've been in gangs that are good guys or bad guys or just trying to get here to have a better life in the U.S. But here's what we ought to do specifically, I think. Specifically, you have to have, I would say, an area in Mexico by the border where you have the U.N. and other organizations that would help any other country that's experiencing a flood of illegal immigrants like we are right now, set up some kind of refugee area where these kids get sheltered, fed, they get medical attention in Mexico. And the Mexican authorities obviously will have a big part to play in this, and then they need to get sorted out and sent home. I don't think that we should be bringing them in the U.S. right now at all.
You know, Congressman, one of the things I'm struck by when we hear the Mexicans railing about our immigration policies is they don't tolerate people coming into their country. And evidently, the young people and others, substantial numbers of others, by the way, that seem to be coming now as part of this invasion are obviously being allowed by them to pass through. If you were to actually seal the border and create these camps and so on, wouldn't the proper place to be to start on the southern border of Mexico rather than the northern border of Mexico? And that's really, I guess, the question that occurs to me is, what role are the Mexicans playing? Are they conniving with these folks to bring not just people from their own country, but from elsewhere in Central America and the Middle East?
I don't think that the Mexican government per se is doing that on purpose, because they're then faced with transiting children and people going through their country. I don't think that they're doing it on purpose. I think that you have the drug cartels, and simply you have large ungoverned areas of Mexico that are kind of the badlands, and you have people paying $5,000-$8,000 to coyotes, bringing them north, telling them that they're going to be in Los Angeles soon, when in reality they're in the Texas desert. So I don't think the Mexican government is actively doing this, but I also don't think that they're actively trying to stop it either. I don't think they have enough manpower, frankly, or the ability to deal with all the problems that they have, and that's why you have. Mexico's not a first world country. That's the reason why. They have too much ungoverned space. They have bad lands, and they have really bad guys, narco terrorists, who are running things. But this is purely a result, I don't think, of Mexico, of the Obama administration. This is not Mexico's fault. This is Barack Obama's fault, and this is his fault, because he has given the false idea to the rest of the world that we don't abide by our laws here, and that if you come here, you're not going to be held to the same law as citizens are, that anybody else are, that you're going to be able to jump to the front of the line and become an American citizen, which is simply not true. Even when the president went around Congress and broke the law, in my opinion, by allowing kids, dreamers, to stay here, that doesn't even include the people that are coming over here now. Even if they granted amnesty to those groups of people that were here before the age of 12, of 2012, this doesn't include those kids that are coming over now.
It certainly seems, though, they've been signaling that it will, and that's, I think, no small reason why we're seeing this sort of magnet effect. Congressman Duncan Hunter, so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll give us a chance to do so again in the near future. Good luck with the hearing today, and thank you for joining us. Peter Pham joins us next on Boko Haram, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families,
including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Dr. Peter Pham. He's the guy we turn to with regularity for matters involving his area of expertise, which is the continent of Africa. And there is a lot going on there at the moment, particularly with respect to some of the larger problems that we've been talking about throughout the program, namely the jihadists' ambitions to not only exercise their campaigns of terror, but to seize and hold territory
from which to become an even more formidable threat in the future. Peter Pham is the director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council and most recently the author of Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. Peter Pham, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Listen, you have been following closely for a long time a group that has gotten a fair amount of attention of late, including from the First Lady, among others, namely Boko Haram in Nigeria. You were telling me off air about your experience trying to address this subject a couple of years back before it got the sort of attention that it is now. Remind us of your first congressional testimony.
Back in 2011, there was a hearing on Capitol Hill, the first ever on Boko Haram. It was held by the House Homeland Security Committee Subcommittee on Intelligence and Counterterrorism to spotlight the release of a bipartisan report led by the chairman of the subcommittee, Congressman Patrick Meehan of Pennsylvania, and the ranking Democratic member, Congresswoman Jackie Speier of California. And at the hearing, literally 9 people showed up. The 2 members of Congress, each had their 1 staffer, the 4 witnesses, and 1 witness brought his wife. That was it. That was all the interest we could generate in Washington for a group that all 4 witnesses warned, and the committee subcommittee's report highlighted was growing into an even more ominous threat.
Yeah. Now, you testified again just recently, and I take it there was a considerably more interest both on the part of members and the audience.
Yeah, so the House Foreign Affairs Committee Subcommittee on Africa, the hearing was held in the full committee hearing room. It was standing room only, and there was a line of people out the door. So quite a difference 3 years made. Unfortunately, if we'd been listened to 3 years earlier, perhaps we wouldn't be at this place with the tragedy that's occurred and continues to occur.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about the nature of that tragedy, Peter Pham. We're all familiar, of course, with the predations of the Boko Haram guys on particularly young women, girls in northern Nigeria. But what are they up to more generally, and really what's animating them?
Well, their official ideology, of course, is to overthrow the Nigerian state. Even those areas of Nigeria where Sharia law has been imposed in the 12 northernmost states, they view it as too lax. So they want a strict Sharia state animated by their version of Islam. In pursuit of that, and this is what has really changed in the last few years, the group, as you mentioned, Frank, like many other extremist groups, no longer just simply carries out hit-and-run attacks or bombings. It's holding territory and using that territory as a base for further attacks. And in northern Nigeria, in the northeastern state of Borno State, for the better part of the last year, Boko Haram has driven the government entirely out of 10 local government areas, roughly the equivalent of our counties. Now, to give a perspective on the size, we're talking about an area that Boko Haram exclusively controls, roughly the size of the state of Maryland. And, of course, it's carrying out attacks beyond that. Just over the weekend, it carried out an attack in an area it didn't control and kidnapped nearly 100 women, as well as some young boys, and then killed a number of other people.
And is it your expectation, Peter Pham, that if left to their own devices, given the apparent weakness of the Nigerian military at the moment, and for that matter, government of Nigeria, that you will see more of this sort of territorial expansionism, including perhaps into the south, that is Christian and predominantly an animist, I guess?
Well, certainly there's going to be expansion. It will take some time before it gets south, but certainly they are targeting Christians. The village of Chibok, where the schoolgirls were kidnapped more than 2 months ago, is, although it's in a predominantly Muslim area, the village itself is a predominantly Christian village, which is worth noting. The other thing is, I want to clarify one thing. The Nigerian military is not resource poor. They spend $6 billion a year at least, if not more, on their military, which may be small compared to the U.S. Defense budget, at least as it has been in the past, but certainly by third world standards, by African standards, it's a tremendous amount of money. The problem is that there's corruption within the military, and so not all that money gets to the front lines or even into equipment, or where they buy equipment, they don't maintain it. For example, several years ago, about 2 years ago, the Nigerian government purchased 12 Israeli Aerostar drones. Barely 2 years later, not one of them flies because someone pocketed the money that was supposed to go into maintenance.
Yeah, Peter Pham, let me ask you, because one of the things that we are certainly witnessing elsewhere, notably in Iraq at the moment, but I gather is taking place in northern Nigeria as well, is that Muslims who are not actually sort of disposed towards the same kind of repressive adherence to Sharia that Boko Haram demands are nonetheless making common cause with them, aligning with them, joining forces with them, and that the possibilities, therefore, of a greater sway in northern Nigeria, you know, cannot be underestimated. Is that your reading of it? And what, if anything, can we do about that?
There's a lot of history, and it's complicated in Nigeria by local politics, but there are a number of leaders, including fairly prominent ones, who have thought that they could somehow ride the tiger and not get eaten or bitten by it. They've passed funding to Boko Haram. They've tried to use it to bring down President Goodluck Jonathan, or at least to discredit him in the lead up to next February's presidential and general elections in Nigeria. So there is a bit of opportunism and an almost Machiavellian use of Boko Haram, which I think will backfire and has, in fact, in several cases, backfired on these cynical leaders. But unfortunately, Boko Haram is more than happy to take it from wherever it can get it. And the reason this is a group that has, you know, greatly expanded its potential. A couple years ago, all it could do was do drive-by shootings. It's now holding territory, carrying out sophisticated bombings, and more or less keeping an entire division of the Nigerian army at bay.
Yeah. A formidable threat, likely to become more so, and one that we best keep our eye on. Peter, let me turn to one other topic quickly with you, and that is Kenya. We've been witnessing Al-Shabaab, another of these Islamist terrorist groups, which had also taken a fair amount of territory in Somalia, which you've documented, of course, in your book, Somalia, Fixing Africa's Most Failed State. But increasingly, Al-Shabaab seems to be operating with impunity in attacking neighboring Kenya, which was trying to put them out of business in Somalia. Give us a quick appreciation of what's happening there.
Well, back when Shabaab was in its heyday, controlling almost two-thirds of south-central Somalia, it attracted various extremists, not just from Somalia, but from the Somali diaspora and other ethnic groups. And what was particularly telling, and people tend to forget this, that the third largest demographic group within Shabaab, the first being ethnic Somalis from Somalia, the second Somalis from the diaspora, the third largest group within Al-Shabaab were actually Kenyans who were non-ethnic Somalis. And many of these people, the irony of the success of the counterterrorism campaign in Somalia, including that which Kenya has carried out, is many of these ethnic non-Somalis have returned to Kenya, where they're largely indistinguishable, at least outwardly, from other members of the population and are thus better equipped and able to carry out attack.
Peter Pham, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you for the terrific work you do at the Atlantic Council. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom.